The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I should say something very nice about Matt Gotritis, the export director here at Dr. Lozen in Moselle. But he's poured us wine again. I should say nice things. He's been generous. We've gone for a two-hour tour. We've gone up these giant hills. We've seen red slate, blue slate. We have seen single vineyards. It's been an incredible last 2 hours. And yet he's poured a mystery wine, and we have to do a blind tasting, which only usually leads to humiliation. Matt, thanks for doing the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I've actually become a listener of your podcast as a result of your visit. So I'm glad you came.
And I appreciate it. When someone says, oh, I listen, I then always feel weird. It's like, oh no, you actually listen to it. I'm like, wait, no, that's sort of the idea of it. There's a lot of places to start here with you. But first, you know, a quick toast. Thank you so much for the last couple hours.
Toast.
Cheers.
Thank you, guys.
Yes. And cheers. So now. Normally, we would start talking about German wines and
you're right.
and Lucen and all that sort of stuff, but now we have to do a blind.
I've listened to the podcast a few episodes, and I've seen you've had Master Sommelier do a blind tasting, mm-hmm. and so
Walden.
I thought I'd show you something a little bit funky here, and just to see what you guys think. It's always risky doing things blind, but I will tell you it is from us, so don't say anything too stupid or crazy.
Okay.
Keep the comments within bounds, but it's definitely something that you have probably never had before.
I'm going to say this. This is a tasty note I've never given. Off the nose, I get a well-made, creamy red tomato soup.
Okay.
I get very vegetal notes. I'm serious. I bet if you think it, you're going to get tomato soup. Red leaf. My nose is going on a very red vegetal area.
Okay. And this is something white in the glass, mm-hmm. as well. So
on the palate, much more light green, light lime, light orange, lime skin.
Okay. Ladies?
Well, they're going to be afraid. They don't want it. They don't want it.
Grandma's basement. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I get from Savio Blanc in New Zealand, I got a lot of green in that. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what
I'm
grape?
Still getting that tomato.
What grape do you think it is?
This is unlike any grape I've had.
Okay.
But I'm going to game the system a little.
Yes.
Bit, you know. So even though we've tried a Chardonnay from this area, I'm not going to say Chardonnay.
Yeah.
When you said before funky, I'm like, oh, maybe it's some sort of crazy Pinot Blanc.
Okay.
But yeah. I can't go Pinot Blanc. Ye Lord, and I mean, the obvious thing would be to say Riesling, so
okay.
It's not going to be that.
Careful,
yeah,
Mr. Cause.
Yeah.
Trust your instincts. I've learned when in doing blind tastings, your first impression is very important, and what happens in blind tastings is you get influenced by the people around you, and then you change, and then all of a sudden it was Bordeaux. And you're like, I knew it was Bordeaux! I should have said it.
Then here's my answer. Okay. I'm going to go obvious. I'm going to say Riesling.
Okay.
Because we're in the bleeping land of Riesling. And the reason I'm going to say Riesling is because there's so many different expressions from this grape.
Yes.
That you could do something that I've never tried or tasted before. So I'm going to go some like really weird, cool climate, like your coldest parts of, you know, around Bernkastel. So I'm going to go with some sort of crazy Riesling. That's going to be...
It's our alcohol removed.
Oh.
It's called Sober.
Oh.
And we also have it in another version, which we're calling Dr. Low. Mm-hmm. And so Sober we came up with because I was approached by an importer. And they wanted to know if we could do alcohol-free. So that you can use, some countries you can use alcohol-removed, alcohol-free. So in Canada, if you're below, I think it's you have to be at 0.05, which this is. Generally, we're even lower. And so this is 100% Mosel Riesling, not chaptalized, vacuum distilled. And what happens when you ferment something, you have the fructose remains in, and so you're... It's what happened. It stays after the fermentation. You have a higher fructose content in this, so that's a sweeter sugar, which gives you the ability to not have to add sugar on the other end. So no added sugar. So sometimes you'll see on the back label of some products where they'll have added sugar or rectified grape must or whatever, And so I wanted to show you this blind because, of course, if I told you it was alcohol-free, alcohol-removed, then there's a stigma that you automatically have.
Right.
And so then you automatically are placing it in that little box. And I wanted your honest opinion. And so I think we've done a really good job with creating something that somebody that is a wine fan can actually have something, maybe your evening ritual, but you don't want to have alcohol every night. Or, people have all kinds of reasons for this category, and it's really growing. And so I'm a huge proponent of this because you don't want to drink every single night sometime.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And there's certainly plenty going on where it's not bland.
Like
when I think of bland alcohol,
yes,
I think of White Claw. Yeah, my first thing was tomato soup.
Yeah, it's interesting. And when you distill or vacuum distill something, obviously you're going to get these, it's going to be different aromas than you get from the Mosel Riesling by itself. I think what we've done is created a product that when shown blind, it doesn't scream I'm alcohol free.
Right.
That is a huge milestone that I think we've reached, that when shown blind, not every person is going to recognize it as alcohol free. And I think that's a major hurdle that you have to get over. And so I wanted to show you that because it's something that we're just starting.
Yeah.
And we're just going to start doing it in Canada. We'll probably do both, the Sober and the Dr. Low, maybe for different channels. It's something I'm really excited about because it's just a new category. And it's a type of customer that maybe never thought of Dr. Low's our company being able to offer them something.
That's really cool. Thank you very much for
that. Bitteschön. You're welcome.
Yeah. Well, let's start first just with where we are. I was wondering if you could, because a lot of people that listen, they're from Ontario, they're at the LCBO. Yeah. They've seen your labels. They might not. And the goal for this interview is to get them to buy your labels. And not that we are at all on our end, that we are some sort of paid influencers. I'm doing this because I've bought your wines tons. And I'm very passionate about this region about Riesling.
Yeah.
And I in the end, all I want is for more people to try the wines. If they don't like them, fine. But to go out and try them and just not be afraid of German Riesling. But first, just a little bit, what should people know about Dr. Lucem?
I'm American, so I'm an outsider to this. I didn't grow up in Germany. My wife is German. I started selling wine in California in 1999. And one of my jobs took me over to Germany to sell to the U.S. military bases. And I met my wife then, and so I understand the stigma that German wines have. I understand how they're difficult to understand. I understand, Riesling, Trockenberg, and Auslese is not something that people get the first time.
No.
When you look at the Mosel, we just did the vineyard tour. Once you get it, once you understand the logic of German wines, they become so much easier to purchase because there's a logical flow to how things are named. So here on the Mosel, I would say the Mosel is probably one of the premier regions for this kind of fruity style balanced with acidity. But as the climate is changing, we are also getting into world-class dry wines as well. So we're actually going to start with a dry wine, which we call Knochen Trocken, which is bone dry. And so analytically, we can say zero sugar. So this will be the first wine that we're going to try. And what I wanted to do today, because I see myself as an outsider, I wanted to give you and people listening just a basic primer on German wines. So if you're ever having to take a WSET or something like that, you can understand, oh, that's how it is. Oh, now I understand. And I want to just break it down into simple bite-sized morsels because I know how difficult it is for people that are just learning it for the first time.
Oh, well, let's. So, which is the first one we can get? We have plenty of helpers here.
So, the first wine is a bone dry Riesling. The concept came up in Germany. They have what's called an Azubi. So, those are trainees, and they at the end of the trainee period, they have a final test, and their test was to make a wine. So, our person that was doing their internship had to make a wine, and they decided they want to do something bone dry. Not typical our style, because Mosel Riesling tends to have high acidity.
Yeah.
High acidity can be difficult in making dry wines because they can be very, very biting and very acidic. Our intern had the wine project, but the intern of our printer had a label project. And so the label came from the printer's intern, And
it looks like a Grateful Dead cover.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's basically two skeleton hands holding a grape. Mm-hmm. And so the wine is bone dry. In German, you would say Knochen trocken. And so we're going to start with this because I wanted to take you up to the different levels. We'll finish with a Bärenauslese, and so that you can see how versatile Riesling is. In my personal opinion, I would say Riesling is the most versatile grape in the world. You'll sometimes go to a region where they'll say, hey, we have this grape. Then I would qualify it saying, okay, Riesling is the most versatile, well-known grape in the world.
Yeah.
And so what I want to show today is that that's actually true. So we're starting with this, bone dry, stainless steel, lees contact, because I think without the lees contact, that would almost be too hard to drink.
Right, yeah.
So we do use lees contact. We also have another project we're doing with the berries in Australia, where we do a wine here on the Mosel, but we do a tiny bit of lees contact because our style and our acidity levels are just so high, we want to make a wine that people can drink. And so I think this wine walks the line of how low Riesling can go in terms of sugar. But when you have this with food, let's say you have something with like ceviche that already has high acidity in general, what that does is it makes this wine a little bit broader because your mouth has been primed for the acidity. And then you have this, and this tastes more broad than it did by itself. This is Mosel Riesling, not from a specific vineyard as well. When we go farther in the tasting, I'll start to explain more about how a single vineyard is named and then how the style of the wines are broken down within the individual predicat levels, we say.
Do you remember a moment where you fell in love with German wine? Because you were telling me on our tour, and we can talk about it, mm-hmm. All the great training you got at Ernest & Gallo. And when you are there in that wine world in America,
yeah.
That could not be more different than where we're sitting right now in Moselle.
Well, Gallo had Mirasu, which had a Riesling. So
I think of what we drank when we mm-hmm. were underage.
No, Gallo, I mean, they've expanded in a lot of different brands. So they had Mirasu. Mirasu had a Riesling, a Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. And so I knew of Riesling. And when I moved over here, I started with the super, you know, you start with the supermarket stuff. And,
yeah.
And you think, oh, wow, that's interesting. You know, that's German wines. And then I moved to another company, a German bottler. And then when I started working here in 2010, you just progress with the different styles based upon the company that you're working for and what that company is known for. I would say the wine I buy the most is the Erdner Treption Riesling Cabinet, and it's the most versatile. And I've shown it when you show it at a table of 15 people, regardless of their level, you have maybe Aunt Martha who drinks one glass a year, and then you have somebody who's a wine expert, you have somebody in the middle, and every single one of them can have a Cabinet and love it. Mm-hmm. Whether they say, oh, wow, this is mineral or saline or salty or whatever, and then the others say, this is sweet, or this. Some say, oh, this is only has 8.5% alcohol. And for me, what I love about Cabinet is the versatility with food. You can have it with spicy, you can have it with salty, you can have it with hard cheese. That for me is why Riesling is so amazing, is it's so versatile. Once I started here, I think the question that may get asked today, then I'll just maybe answer it in advance, is do I have that one wine that changed my life? I have the concept that changed my life, and the concept was blind tasting, which I did with you guys here.
Yeah.
But we do old world, new world, and we'll do that tonight at dinner. And the concept of blind tasting an old world, new world puts you alone to your senses and what you think it is. That was where you really learn, is this good or is this not? You're not buying it because of label, because you don't know the label. And then you start to really see what you like. And I find I like Northern Rhone. I find I like Old Bordeaux. I find I like this. And then you find, oh, I really don't like that.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe you should like that, but I don't. And then you start to realize, wow, it's okay to like something that maybe isn't that expensive. It's okay to like something that's extremely expensive that I didn't know it was expensive. And the blind tasting was what really opened my eyes to, wow, I'm allowed to decide what's good and not somebody else telling me that.
And how cool is it, by the way, when you find a wine that you love and it's half the price that you expected? It's such a great feeling.
Yeah, I would say Washington State Syrah is one of the ones. My wife loves Columbia Crest Washington State Syrah.
Yeah, they do good stuff.
And you bring it to a friend's house for a barbecue and they're like, hey, how much is this? And you tell them how much it is. They're like, wow, what? It's so... And so that style, that the fruity and drinkability, that's great for when you want wines at home, or you're going to friends that maybe you're not sure their experience level. The geeky stuff, you save that for the, you know, when Matthew Kaas comes over and you want to say, hey, what do you think of this stuff?
Yeah.
And you don't want to waste something on somebody that doesn't get it, because then it's so sad when they say, oh, this smells old. And then you say, no, no, why? Why did I do that?
Hold on, wait. Okay, what's worse? I'm going to give you two options.
Okay.
Option one is that scenario you just did.
Yes.
Option two is when either by mistake by you or someone else, they open up one of the nice bottles at the end of the night. And the worst thing is the next day you go, yeah, I don't remember drinking that.
They
suck.
For the feeling in my gut, because I think I get to drink enough good wines, the feeling in my gut is the wasted bottle on somebody, mm-hmm. because I maybe misjudged them or I wanted to do something nice, and then all of a sudden it backfired on me. So my wanting to do something nice backfired, my showing it to them backfired, because then you have maybe the half glass just sitting there the whole night and they're like, they're not going to finish that, are they? They're not going to finish
and
that.
And you just want to grab it. You just want to grab it and drink it.
like dumping the spit bucket on your face or something.
Yeah. By the way, there are two people here that were once responsible when I went to bed because I was doing morning radio.
Oh.
And they opened up an old bottle. It was a Northern Rhone. It was an old Northern Rhone, and they didn't realize.
Oh no!
They thought it was just a Gugel Cote de Rhone.
Landandona, Hushi.
I found them asleep on the couch, both of their heads next to each other, and it was 4:30 in the morning, and I'm just like, I am so angry at you right now. What I love about this first wine here is this is the pour this for the person that says, no, I don't want to have the German wine. It's too sweet.
Yep.
Like, I think giving this would be, oh, wait a minute.
Yep.
You know, and it's much like with people, people think, oh, Canadian wine is just all ice wine, or people, oh, Australia, it's all Yellowtail.
Yep.
It's that one thing about Germany, and that's part of this podcast, is no, it's not all syrupy Black Tower. You need to stop thinking like that.
As the climate allows these regions to make these drier styles, you can have fantastic winemakers that have new bullets in their gun mm-hmm. that are they can then say, wow, maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I couldn't do this style. And now they can. And because they're great winemakers, they understand the balance of fruit and acidity. They understand what needs to be done.
Fine. Yeah, that's, as you mentioned, the Lees. Oops, let me move that. That's the Lees that's doing that. So what's wine number two?
Wine number two is called Blauschiefer. In German, you would say blue slate. So Blau is blue, Schiefer is slate. We came up with this concept because when we get farther into the podcast, you'll see that we have single vineyards. But also, you have to have estate wines that you can have by the glass that everyday customers, everyday restaurants can have, where you have less chance of running out of stock. So when we were doing the tour, you saw one side of the Mosel, which would be the Bernkastel, Vale, and Grach side, has more bluish slate, more gray slate. And so in order to have a wine which is indicative of the soil type and a wine that we can have in stock, we decided to do the Blauschiefer. And so we have a Rotschiefer and a Blauschiefer, and those are the two dry, you would maybe say white tablecloth by the glass type of wines from us.
Right.
And so this is an ambassador for the Mosel in the dry style on the blue slate side. And you should see more roundness, more fruitiness than you saw on the Knochen Trocken. This is more approachable. The Knochen Trocken is more of a niche type wine. Generally, people have the association that German wines are sweet, so you have to be careful that you don't make them too dry because it'll be a shock to their system. For the export markets, we generally put an extra dry sticker, an extra tag, so it'll say Riesling dry, blue slate, and then another dry sticker on it to basically hit you over the head that the wine is dry because of the stigma that Riesling is sweet.
I think I enjoy the off-dry and the sweets as much as I do the dries, just because the well-made ones, the acidity is there.
Yep.
It is not a heavy, I like to use the word gloopy, which is not a real word, but it, you know, when you drink like an
it
overly
sounds like a
sweet,
cartoon term or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it's gloopy, like an overly sweet thing. Yeah. It's just pulling your whole mouth down,
yeah.
And it's not really lifting it up.
Exactly. And so the thing about German wines is we're going up the levels, you know, the bone dry, moving up a level, but they're extremely drinkable. Mm-hmm. You could have a glass of this and you would want a second one. This, you could just drink a glass of it and just enjoy it. And that's what I think we've done a good job of, just creating something for who the customer is. And I think I listen to a lot of podcasts. It's very important to know who your customer is. And if you're looking and saying, what does the customer want from us? Instead of saying, we're going to push this on you and you better like it. We could push bone dry on somebody, but there would be a lot of people that wouldn't get it. And pretty soon they wouldn't like our style. And so this fruity style is great for the person who was in the restaurant, who is just getting out of the initial fruity stages of Riesling and wants to try the dry. But it's interesting you say you like the sweeter styles, the fruitier styles.
Yeah.
That comes with being confident in your wine knowledge. It's like a circle. You start out with the fruity style, and then people maybe mock you, or they tell you you shouldn't be drinking that, and then you get scared, and then you start drinking more and more. Maybe you go to other countries. Eventually, you come back. Eventually, you've been drinking wine long enough that you don't care what they say, and then you tell them, try this cabinet with this spicier dish you're having, and then they try it and they're like, oh, Matt, wow, that's fantastic. Or my favorite is Le Gruyère, hard Swiss yep. cheese. Le Gruyère and Erdener Treppchen Cabinet is about the best food pairing I've ever come across. I think everybody should drink what they like. We talked about the word snob, whether wine snobs or beer snobs. I think you have a right to drink whatever you want. And if you like a wine that's 10 US dollars or 10 euros or 10 Canadian and it gives you joy, and you try something better than that wine and it doesn't give you more joy, then great for you. You've got a deal.
It seems one common theme here, just chatting with you right now about Lucen, is there seems to be just a heavy emphasis on reaching out to as many different customers. You sort of talked about it, and especially I think this is more of an old world thing, mm-hmm. which is, here is our wine, you must love it because we've been around for 700 years. Mm-hmm. But with you, the first thing we tried was a wine with no alcohol. Then we tried this really bone dry fella. Like, that feels to me like that you guys, and I don't know what it's like in the area, but that you're trying to reach out to more audience than maybe some traditional winemakers.
Well, if you see how many miles, airline miles that Ernst Losen has, you know that he goes around and sits on panels and teaches and talks about Riesling, not just Dr. Losen, but Riesling in general. Riesling Rendezvous in Washington State. He does the Eroica project with Chateau St. Michel. He does two projects with the Berries. He does two projects with Telmo Rodriguez. He was just in Lofoten in Norway. I mean, he had to get on like a airplane, like flying in like bad weather. He couldn't even land at the airport he was supposed to land at. He had landed a separate one and then come to the... And so he's going to all these different places educating people because Riesling is so fantastic. This particular project, we're not gonna take over the world with bone dry, but we're gonna educate people. And if we do a little bit, and there's a customer in this country that likes it, and there's a customer in this country that gets it, and somebody in the Scandinavian market gets it, and it fits something that their mentality and their food fits to, then we have it for them, and we're not afraid. And we're not afraid if this fails, and we just don't make it the next year.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. We have enough successful brands and enough successful wines in the portfolio that we have the luxury of trying things out. Alcohol-free, alcohol-removed. We have that luxury because we're making fruity-style Riesling anyway, and then if we take a batch and we vacuum distill it, and it works, we have a whole new client base that maybe would never, or had a period where they couldn't drink our wines or whatever. We've now added a whole new client base.
I by the way, and I'm sure some people, they're going to try the bone dry. Next thing you know, they're drinking 25-year-old Oschlesi. Okay, so now we're going to sort of bounce back and forth between Wine Geek and you. How did you get hooked up with Lucen?
Well, I started in California, got yep. moved over to the military division, went back, and then back to Germany. I worked another roughly 2 years for another German bottler. And it turns out the woman who was working in my office, who was doing my secretary work and also shipping type stuff, dealing with customers, she was in a vineyard tour group, walking group, with a person that still works for us. And I was considering, maybe I'll start my own business. And then I just ended up getting in touch with Ernst Losen via the person that works for us. She mentioned that there was somebody that wanted to speak with him, and he's like, "Ah, I don't know." And then she's like, "Yeah, but he's American." He's like, "Oh, that's interesting." Hmm. And so literally in the chair I'm sitting in right now, Ernie was sitting in this chair, and I came in and made my little pitch to him.
What was your pitch?
My pitch was I came up like with a brand name that I had, like a cool brand name that I thought, and just giving him who I am, basically. And he's like, "You want to go have a drink?" Okay, so we went upstairs, because right now we're sitting in kind of the just outside of the library. Upstairs is where his room is. I think for him it was, can I have a drink with this guy? I know his resume. You know, he worked here, he worked there. Obviously, he's American, he's living here. I mean, he can speak German well enough, so he can't be a complete fool. So, but can I hang out with this dude?
Right.
And I think that is actually, it's an overlooked part of the interview process. Do you enjoy actually the spending the time with the people that you're hiring? And if you can go and have a glass of wine with somebody and chat, and they can talk about the wine intelligently, and you can talk about other things, at the end of the day, you're going to be on a flight together. At the end of the day, you're going to be somewhere in Hong Kong together. You're going to be tired. And if you're annoying each other, it's horrible working with those people. I think it was really an interesting interview process. In the wine industry, I think it's a proper interview process.
And also, it's like I tell every intern that wants to get into radio, you know, they'll ask, well, what how do I get ahead? What do I got to do? And I always start with be on time, say yes, don't be a dick. If you can do those three things, you're already ahead of a lot of the crowd.
And also in the beginning, you have to be ready to do dirty work. I mean, when you start out, you're schlepping cases. I've cut my thumb. My acne was, you know, you're dripping with sweat and you get dust from the boxes and everything. You start out lifting more than you're talking about, you know, Grand Cru Burgundies. Mm-hmm. And so once you realize that there's that level and you reach another level where you get to talk about the fine wine, you really appreciate all levels of it. And so I really enjoy the fact that I got to experience so many parts of the wine industry, from a large bottling plant to sales. And I think I mention this a lot, but I think wine is about the stories. And if you can make fantastic wine, and the science of making wine and all of these different things is so, you can find out how to do that. You can make home beer, you can do these things, but what's your story? What are you telling people that they can latch onto you? If the wine and the story are great, people remember that and then go back for the next thing, the next vintage launch. They're ready for it because they believe in your story.
You went to school, was it ASU?
No, don't say that. I'm from Tucson.
Oh, God, Tucson. Oh, I said Arizona State.
You know? Yes, you did.
Oh, my God, I am
Can we stop
sorry.
This podcast right this, now? Or
This no. is one of the biggest insults into when I called like Bordeaux Burgundy or something. Oh, my God.
But it's okay because
Actually, wait, I just got a degree from ASU as we were talking. It was a true and false 20 questions. So
I have a lot of nieces that went to ASU, so it's okay. But if you're from Tucson, it's very difficult for you to hear ASU. I went to school in New Mexico, Albuquerque. Right. So I went to UNM. I really like that because Albuquerque is just far enough away from Tucson that I had to be my own person. Mm-hmm. It's around 6 hours away. And so you can't call mom and dad for everything.
Yeah.
And that actually helps you grow up a lot faster. If I went to U of A, or even if I went to ASU, you could always go home on the weekend for your parents and they could always, you know, give you money and this and that.
Yeah.
When you're alone and you have to make it on your own, that helps you grow up, and that helps you. And then I moved to Germany. I mean,
well, that sort of goes to where I was heading before I insulted your educational background. How is it for you as someone who grew up in Southwest America, mm-hmm. now living and working in Germany?
I have 7 older brothers and an older sister, and my parents were born in 1932 and they're still living. And so I have a lot of, you know, whether it's music, whether it's history or whatever it is, I have a lot of influences. And I love culture, I love languages, and I love the fact that you can cross the border into France and you can be eating in the Alsace Flammkuchen, and then you could cross the border into Switzerland and you could be in the Alps, and then you can do here and do that. And America is so gigantic that you know, even if you're from Tucson, you don't see the Grand Canyon that often because it's things are far away. The closeness of Europe, and if you're open to other cultures, and if you're open to other experiences, and if you're open to being stupid and not an expert in something, you have a much better chance of people being nice to you and accepting you. I love the experience, and that's helped me get out of, you know, I've lived in California, I've lived in Texas, I've lived in New Mexico and Arizona. And so I have that Southwest mentality, but being open to other people allows you to have fun pretty much anywhere in the world. But Germany is very safe. It's a very modern. It's very clean. It's very organized. And so there's a lot of positive things. And the things that I miss about America, I can go back and get and tank up. Although with COVID, it's been a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
But the things you miss, you can always tank up and then you come back over here. But what you don't want to do is always complain and say, oh, it's so much better there. There's always going to be differences. And so, and my wife is German, so you just get indoctrinated into the culture anyway. And I have children, so we have, I speak English with them, so I still have, I can teach my child about the Constitution or about Hamilton or whatever. I'm teaching them something that they're probably never going to get in the German school system. I'm the one that's teaching them about these things. And so it's actually quite fun.
By the way, if you want to slice a home, we can talk about Kyler Murray or what the hell happened to the Phoenix Suns against the Dallas Mavericks. Or, you know, if you want, I'm here for 3 minutes
for
on
consoling.
Devin, for 3 minutes on consoling. And
before this podcast, I actually watched some primers on Canadian football, just to see what's the differences,
right,
where the goalposts, the wider field, the longer.
Yeah.
You get 1 point if you try a field goal and miss it, and this type of thing. And so I try to do a little of homework in case I get like a I knew you're a sportscaster, so
yeah.
I didn't want to embarrass myself. You do miss that because I'm not really talking Bundesliga with anybody. I mean, did you see the Champions League? I don't really do that. I played soccer growing up, but it's not something. I don't have a buddy that we're talking about these things, and you don't really have that over here.
Well, so what's the next wine we're going to try?
We're going to try Gosses Gewächs. The thing about Gosses Gewächs, it may sound complicated, but it's actually quite easy. GG is the symbol you'll see. You'll see on the bottle, there's the letters GG with the grape symbol. And so Gosses Gewächs means great growth. You would say Grand Cru, and so in France. And it has to be a dry wine.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in what's called the VDP, which is a Wine Growers Association. Basically, it's some of the top wineries in Germany. And they've come up with this system where the top dry wine from a top site, in German you would call it a große Lage. Lage is the site. So we're drinking the Kinheimer Rosenberg Riesling GG. So a dry wine. And it has to be basically Spätlese or late harvest quality and then fermented into a drier style. So it is a single vineyard. So now is the time when I can explain the single vineyard. So Kinheim is the village. ER means belonging to, so you would say Kinheimer, and then Rosenberg is the name of the vineyard, so Rose Mountain, or Rosenberg, Roses Mountain, and you see Wehlener Sonnenuhr, the sundial from the village of Wehlen, Erzig of Erzgarten, the spice garden from the village of Erzig. Once you understand the naming principle, you understand, oh, single vineyard, oh, I see GG, it's dry, you turn the bottle around, you see the alcohol, 12.5%, now I know exactly what I'm getting. Before, it can be very intimidating and confusing. Once you understand, once somebody that gives you the legend on how to read it, it's much easier to purchase German wines.
On this fella here, if you were talking someone through it in terms of nose and palate, where would you take them?
I'd mention one thing we focus on is lees contact, because we have this high acidity. This lees contact gives you this nice mouthfeel. So this comes from the red slate side. When we did the tour, you have the more blue slate, as I said, Wehlener, Grach, and Berncastle. This is now on the Erzig, Erden, Kinheim side. I tend to find these red slate wines have to have a little bit more power. They become a little bit more tropical. They're a little bit riper. Whereas in the Wehlener, Sonnenuhr, you might have apples, white, peach, and leanness. These wines, you tend to find them to be more powerful, but you also have the elegance of the acidity. When I try this wine, I find you get the mouthfeel from the lees contact, you get the fruitiness from the Riesling grape, you get the acidity from the Riesling grape, and when you balance all of those things together, you have one of the top white wines that you can have in the whole world, because Riesling is able to combine sweetness, acidity, and mouthfeel all in this one package. It's not discombobulated, it's not disjointed, it's seamless. very typical Mosel. We talked about the word mineral, but when you breathe these in, you almost have this feeling like, I don't know, like mineral dust chips are flying up into your nose. And it's like you're being inundated by some sort of like minty mineral attack on your nose hairs.
I like minty. That's good.
There's like, it's for yeah. me, it's like that toothpastey, minty, mineral refreshing, like toothpaste, they put that, you get that flavor, so you feel like, oh, my teeth are clean.
Yeah.
and you kind of get that. When I drink it, it's so refreshing, so delicious, so yes. fruity, so balanced, so elegant, and all of those things rolled up into one. And that's the beauty of Riesling. And even though it's in a drier style, it's so drinkable. And sometimes drinkable can be confused with simple, but this is drinkable in a top wine of the world that you can actually sit down with all of us at the table and say, man, oh man, that is tasty.
You're absolutely right. And by the way, you're right. There are certain terms that have a positive and negative.
Yeah.
Drinkable screams, oh, you're inexpensive.
Yeah.
You're kind of boring, but you won't offend me. Barbecue wine. Can be great, yeah. You know, barbecue wine. It's all this acid. It's going to cut through the meats and fats. Or barbecue wine. Hey, you're enjoying barbecue, so you won't realize the wine you're drinking is shit.
Yeah,
like it's funny. Like pizza wine
yeah.
can be wonderful, or yeah. you know, they have mixed meanings.
They do, and that's why I'm careful with the term, but it's also true, and so I'm not afraid to say it because yeah. we could polish off this bottle. And we would say at the end, man, that was a really good bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And we just drank it. And we didn't have to, it wasn't heavy. It wasn't, it didn't coat our mouth with tannins. It wasn't something that we had to force down and finish the last drops. We would be done with it and say, oh, is there any more of that Rosenberg? Oh, no, it's gone. Oh, man. Okay. Whew. Another bottle or what?
Let's go nerdy for a second. The importance of slate.
We talked about, there's debates whether slate can actually influence the flavor, you know, does it give it its minerality? I tend to think these vines are going down, digging into this soil. And when you're at different vineyard sites, you picked up different things. I think you're picking up something of the slate in the wine. Slate also has potassium. It's a natural fertilizer. I think that also helps. But slate also keeps in heat. So we were in the vineyards, and because you have the inclination of the vineyards, the sun is hitting the slate at a much better angle than if the vineyard were flat. And so we touched several pieces of slate in the vineyard, and you could feel them getting hot. That is keeping in the heat, and then it can give it back. And because we're around 49th parallel here, so quite far in the north, ripeness is key. And so you have some parts of the world that don't have to worry about ripeness. Maybe they have a problem with too much ripeness. What we are interested in is ripeness. And the German wine system is built on ripeness, the sweetness level at harvest. And so the top vineyards tend to be closest to the Mosel. They tend to have slate soils. They tend to be steep slopes. We were in the Erdener Prelat just below it, and you had that last part where the cliff was almost hanging over it.
Yeah.
And then from the Prelat, we could feel, there was a breeze today, but we could feel warm in the Prelat. Then we went up to the Wirtsgarten, also a top site, but we were farther up in the Wirtsgarten, and there was that one moment where you felt the breeze hit you, and you felt, oh, it's cooler, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's cooler than the Prelat. These different levels of the vineyards can produce different types of ripeness, and so that slate can help increase the warmth of the vineyard.
When I see Cabernet versus Spatlese, and we've talked about it a bit, but this is for the listener that's
yes.
getting into German wine. When they see those two words, what are the couple Cole's notes they need to know about each of those?
Cabernet is the first, what we call Prädikat. And so on German wines, you have the Qualitätswein. And the Qualitätswein is, you get this number that showed that the wine has met these certain qualities and that the wine can then be released. It is what it says it is, basically. And then you have what's called the Prädikat. And the Prädikat is a wine with special qualities. And this special qualities is this natural ripeness. So the first level of natural ripeness without chaptalizing or adding sugar to increase the alcohol level, basically, is called Cabernet. So the Cabernet is, generally, we make them in the fruity style. And then the next level of sweetness at harvest, in Germany, we have what's called Öxle. And Öxle is the level of sweetness that is compared to 1 liter of water and 1 liter of the must. And then you can do a calculation, and then you can calculate the Öxle level. And so Spätlese has a higher Öxle level than Cabernet. You can downgrade a Spätlese to Cabernet, which you can also downgrade an Auslese to Cabernet, but that means you have a very full, fruity, sweet Cabernet, which defies the whole purpose of it.
Right.
But there's nothing stopping you from downgrading it. Once you've crossed the level, you can go back down to it. So for us, we like to keep this Cabernet. So we're going to show an Erziger Würzgarten Cabernet. We like to keep them, I don't know, 8.5%, 8% alcohol in the fruity style, elegant, maybe more greener grapes than they would be getting more yellow in Spätlese. And so it's just a level of sweetness at harvest. And once you understand that, you could have a Spätlese Trocken. Let's say it had 12% alcohol. You would then know, okay, they've taken that sweetness level and the winemaker has then fermented that sugar down.
Yep.
But when you ferment sugar, you also create alcohol. And the higher the alcohol is, the more sugar you've then fermented down. So you could have a Spätlese in the fruity style and a Spätlese Trocken in the dry style. And once you look at the alcohol, that's your key for knowing how sweet it's going to taste on your palate.
Yeah.
Roughly.
Yeah, no, it's a great way to describe it. It's also why we've tried different Auslese, which I came in expecting them to be all this big, rich.
Yeah.
And then you try other ones, like, oh, wait a minute, this feels so much drier and more just streamlined minerality than some of the ones that I'm used to.
That's the acidity.
Yeah.
The acidity is cutting through that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have it also whether they have botrytis in their Auslese.
Right.
If you have a botrytis selection, like a gold capsule, then you might get honeyed aromas. You might get more mouthfeel, maybe apricot honey. And so you can kind of tell by the alcohol, and you can also kind of tell by the honeyed aromas and how cloyingly sweet it is. But if you have an Auslese with no botrytis, it was just a healthy vintage Auslese ripeness level that they then left the residual in. Maybe it has 8.5%, but you have the nice acidity. That acidity is cutting through, I like to say, maybe roughly 8 grams per liter of sugar. The acidity can make you think that it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have 9 grams or 8 grams or 7 grams, that can affect how the sugar feels in your mouth. So when somebody says, Matt, what's the RS on this? I can tell them, but I also have to tell them the acidity, because if the RS is something, but it's got really high acidity, that will make the sugar taste less sweet, or your perception of it.
Which wine are we trying next?
We're going to try the Erziger Würzgarten Riesling Cabernet. So what's the village?
That is Unzgarten.
Erzig.
Erzig.
And the vineyard?
Is Würzgarten.
Würzgarten, sehr gut.
Yes.
See, I tried to look up your last name because it could be German, Kautz, but it's actually, you pronounce it Kaus.
It's actually Northern Italian. It's actually very dramatic influence. It actually was originally pronounced Kaus.
Yeah, so I would say Kautz, because this German Z is a TS sound.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to figure out, I was like, so I actually have a quiz question for you about your last name.
Okay.
I can actually do your quiz question right now.
Okay.
Because we've brought up the subject. Because when I saw your name, I wanted to say Kautz.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, I would not call it Kautz. I would call it something. You say cause.
I think it was because my parents looked at me and I was a chubby little 5-year-old. Like, don't go to school with something that sounds close to cow. That's going to ruin you for the next decade.
According to forebears.io,
mm-hmm.
where is the highest concentration of the name cause? Two places.
I'm going to say Alba, Italy.
You've got Italy. That's number one. So, next one is a country, another country. You don't have to be that specific.
Okay, I didn't think that specific. Okay, so I was going to say Italy, and then I'm going to go with, I'm not going to go Canada, because I once looked it up in the phone book.
And there's like three of you.
Yeah, and they're all related to me. So I'm
Tony.
Yeah, exactly. Like, hey, there's my brother Dave. There's Jason.
That doesn't count.
I'm going to go with Switzerland.
It's Brazil.
Brazil. That was my next guess. Because when you think Switzerland, you often think Brazil, because those countries are so similar.
No, they're not.
You show up in one, and you're like, am I in Switzerland?
Is this Sao Paulo or Lucerne?
Yeah,
I don't know the difference.
No difference.
Yeah.
None at all.
Yeah.
Maybe a little. Really, Brazil.
That's what I looked up. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised it was Italy, but if it's Northern Italy, then it's kind of, it can be the Germanic influence, but I would say Kautz.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard you pronouncing it Kaus, so I didn't want to want to offend anybody.
No, I've mispronounced my own name on radio before.
But if you want to know how to pronounce it, the AU sound in German is an AU sound, mm-hmm. and then Z is a TS, so you would say Kautz.
All right. What is more insecure, me trying to pronounce German villages.
That was pretty insecure.
Or Lindsay, who is pouring the wine right now. Which one feels more insecure to you? It's got to be pretty close. It's got to be pretty
close. There's the real answer, and then there's the correct answer. And so I'm going to go with you pronouncing Erzige Wurzgarten.
Go with that. Go with that.
But I'm not going to say whether that's the real or the correct answer.
No, it's not. But we'll just
because these ladies are so nice.
They are.
I have three
nice
daughters. Mm-hmm. I have a wife. I have a mother-in-law. And so I want people to listen to this podcast episode without being offended.
By the way, do you need any more water?
I would love some still. The clear one, please.
The clear one. All right. Let me throw that over to you. It's okay. There you go.
Thank you.
So I want to go back to something from earlier in the conversation. You said your time with Ernst Lösen when you guys had a drink and that helped him hire you. What was that drink like? I'd be curious about what that day was like.
I think it was Dr. Lösen Weissburgunder Pinot Blanc, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing about Ernst is he speaks English very well, so you can switch back German English. He and I in German you have this thing where you have Sie, which like in Spanish you have usted, yeah, and tu, so you have the different levels of politeness. In German you have Sie und du, and so it's different when an American is speaking with a German, because if you switch into English, it's difficult to me to go from Herr Lösen to to Ernie. So automatically, as an American, you have to be kind of per du, because it's difficult once you switch into English. Everybody is du in English. Maybe if you're speaking to grandpa or something, or you might speak more politely, or you might say Mr. or Sir. But in German, you have a different way of speaking. The language in a way changes based upon your relationship with that person. And so because his English is so good, because he's so international and worldly, and also I was there was no position, there was no job, there wasn't anything that they were saying we're looking for this.
Right.
I saw that this was a successful name, and there was an opportunity. And so I saw the chance to have a position, and ultimately my kind of position back then filled into kind of in the U.S. creating the chain business, the large retailers, because there's a language that chain people speak. And it's like, hey, what's your SKU count? And all these different words that is there a SKU rat going on? You know, that's the rationalizing the SKUs that are in the shop or whatever, but you just use these different language types. And that's what I knew. And so Dr. L was right on the cusp of being a chain retail brand. And that I came in right at that time in 2010, where it was the perfect time to take Dr. L to kind of that chain retail level. And so that worked out really well for me. And now we have our own import company in the US, Lösen Brothers USA Limited. And so working with your own company is very easy, because you all have the same goals as the importer and the supplier. And so I created this position. I think back then it was export manager. Now it's export director. It doesn't really matter. And when you're in a family company, titles really, they don't really mean anything. You know, in America, it's funny. Sometimes you go to a company and they're like, oh, vice president. And you're like, and normally that would just be like area manager.
Right.
But the title of vice president is important, so people need these titles. Whereas us, I have Ernie above me, his brother Tomas. That's who's above me, and so it doesn't matter what I'm called. I could say tomorrow to Ernie, Ernie, I want to be vice president of global operations.
Ooh, that sounds great.
But it wouldn't matter, because I would still have the same pay and the same job.
Yeah, that's true.
But
you'd have a cool business card, you know.
Yeah, and I could put it in different languages, like Vizepräsident des globalen Geschäftes.
Oh, yeah. that even sounds more impressive in German than it does in English.
It's longer. It sounds longer.
Yeah. How long? Some of the vineyards are hundreds and hundreds of years old. We've visited some that are as young as 1988. What's the quick little brief history of Lösen?
Well, Ernst took over. Basically, his father was more, he was a lawyer, and you can see this library here. So Ernst took over, he studied archaeology, and there's not too many archaeology jobs anymore floating around. And so when asked who was going to take over, his family kind of decided, okay, Ernie, you're going to take over or be without a job. And so he took over in 1988 and combined everything under the Dr. Lozen name. Before, when we were driving through Erzig, his father was from Erzig and his mother, her family was from Velen. And so Ernst, right now, we're in his mother's house. And so he combined everything under Dr. Lozen. And then I think that was one of the first steps of us being successful was the simplicity. Because once you step out into the international markets, you realize how difficult German wines are to understand. And if you excuse me, if you can break that down simply for people and they say, oh, Dr. Lozen, oh, I get it. I've seen that guy before. I've seen that name before. And then he went around the world just talking about Riesling, teaching people about Riesling, telling people what Erzig of Erzgarten means. ER is like New Yorker. ER, you're from New York. Wurzgarten means spice garden. I don't know how many times I've said that to people.
Yeah.
But it doesn't get old because you understand every time I meet new people, I have to explain it in the simplest way. So his going around teaching people, not just about Dr. Lozen, but about Riesling as a grape, I think was appreciated by people because he wasn't just saying, oh, look how great I am. He was saying, look how great Riesling is. Look how great this region is. You guys think it's cheap and sweet. It's not. Look at this. No. You can make fantastic wines. And so he built it on teaching. And we're still teaching today. We just went on a, what, the vineyard tour was like 2 hours. We don't have to do that. You guys could have shown up. We did the podcast. You guys go on your way.
Right.
But how much more did you learn by seeing the vineyards, by touching the soil? And then you guys go back, you guys tell people, you guys become ambassadors. And I think that's what we need on something like German wine that's not self-explanatory. That's why I think he's been so successful, and also recognizing, like the Dr. L, that there's a need for the entry level to be good and at a price point that people can buy, or you can have buy the glass in a restaurant that people can try it. And I'd say, I've tried that Dr. L. What else does this guy do? Oh, I've tried the Dr. L and the vintages release. And I also see he's got a Cabinet coming over. I also see he's got this coming over. Oh, the Erdner Prelat Auslese. It's not cheap, but people might be willing to try it because of past experiences. We've got a Prelat Gold Capsule, a Himmelreich GG, a Blue Slate Cabinet, a Sonnenor GG, a Wurzgarten GG. These are vintages releases that are either coming or that I've got in my notes here. When did we think several years ago we would have GGs coming over to Canada? It's all a process of starting and teaching and starting with Dr. L, proving it can work.
And that's kind of what this podcast is meant to be. It's meant to be an ambassador. And again, not because we're on the payroll, but because we are passionate about these wines and about this area. And as you're opening the last wine, which I know requires a corkscrew, in terms of price, what I would tell people is the margin, the profit margins are not high. When you see how difficult it is to farm these wines and just the process and the amount of humans that go into making a bottle, like this is a heavily human heavy intensive wine just to make these.
Definitely.
These are not machines. These are not grab all the grapes, throw them in a bin, you know, crush them, stainless steel for 6 months and then plop them onto the market. There is so much work and effort that goes into these wines.
There's a saying, how do you make a small fortune in the wine industry?
Have a big fortune.
Start with a large fortune.
Yeah, I got that one right.
Because it's a family company, there's so much of the focus is on the wine, the story, the teaching, and profit margins and everything. Is if we're living and surviving and Ernie's got his money, we're not discussing all of these. We don't have these big meetings where we're talking about, you know, what, you know, we need to raise this price to get here. Obviously you need to make money to keep going. Mm-hmm. And with the cost of bottles and labels and all these shortages and all the shipping costs, you can't be stupid. But you also have to realize people at the end of the day have to be able to afford and buy this stuff to drink it and then buy the next bottle. And we focus a lot on what does that market need? What can the market bear? How many bottles of, you know, can we give to that market at that price? Does it make sense having that wine in that market anymore? Can this market handle a GG? Can we make it, you know, does it make sense? And we do a lot of just looking at the individual markets as their own entity and just working and saying, okay, does this make sense here? Should we even be doing that there? And if it makes sense and we can continue doing it, then we can do it. We don't expect our importers to do any more than the market can bear.
Right.
We don't come and hammer them and say this, this, and this. And I hope if any of our importers listen to this, they know we want, if the market can bear a pallet of that, then they should do a pallet.
Yeah.
If they do a half pallet, they're not doing what the market can do. We want them to be the best they can be with what the market allows for German wines. And if we are the most recognized in the market, and if we're selling wines and we're making enough money that we're not going under and that, you know, people can get paid, that's what's important. And if you were to sit in our meetings, you might even be shocked at how little business speak we use. You know, what are the KPIs and this and that?
Yeah.
It's literally about the wine. If you talk to Ernie, it's about his great-grandfather and how he made it and the barrels and all the money we're investing. And so that's what's important. And in the end, if people believe in what you're doing, then they buy your stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're focused on.
You keep the lights on, you pay the mortgage, and you get to go on vacation every now and then. Of course, with you with three kids and...
Four kids.
Oh my God, you have four kids.
Yeah.
Woo!
That didn't just happen. That was just...
Yeah, like, no.
The fourth kid didn't just appear.
It was earlier today. What are we drinking on this final wine?
So are you brave enough to try and pronounce it?
Of course I am.
All right, here
I'm
we go.
I'm awesome at it.
All right, let's do it.
Oh, this is a 2018 Riesling Bier Nischlasse.
Okay.
Oh, no, wait. Auslese, Bier und Auslese.
Bären auslese.
Bären auslesen.
That's good.
Yes, da.
So aus means out of, like auslese means out of the harvest. Bären are berries. So these are berries out of the harvest. So this is then a Botrytis selection. A good way to remember my last name, Gidritis, is Botrytis.
Yep.
And so Botrytis is this fungus that gets on the skins, pierces the skins, the water evaporates, and that's where you get these kind of honeyed aromas.
Yep.
Very typical of Botrytis. Some people talk about Eiswein. Mm-hmm. For my money, I think Botrytis-sized Bären Auslese is one of the best value dessert wines that you can get, because Eiswein is interesting and a novelty. Bären Auslese has many layers because you have the Botrytis. You have these honeyed aromas, you have apricot, you have acidity, you have mouth weight, you have balance. If you try Bären Auslese with maybe a blue cheese, blue vein cheese, fantastic. You have to be careful because the acidity, if you serve it with a dessert that's sweeter than or has the perception of sweetness that's more than this, then the acidity can kick in of the Bären Auslese and it can be a little bit annoying. But the right type of dessert that this sugar can overpower it is fantastic, but blue vein cheese is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Bären Auslese. Less politically correct is foie gras. More politically correct may be like tofu foie gras, but I don't know if that exists.
Okay. It's more important for you to hold your proper perception. Foie gras is delicious and wonderful and would go great with this. And anyone who doesn't know what foie gras is, it's when goose get to live on this magical farm and they live a full life. And at their final days, they waddle up fat and satisfied to the farmer and says, I would like to become foie gras. Yeah. And the farmer takes a magic wand and goes, boop, and then it becomes foie gras on your plate.
Okay.
And that is 100% how it is.
Is that how they
done.
Tell you in sports casting class?
Oh,
what foie gras is?
Well, see, the thing is, it's sports cast. You know, when you're on air, you can bend the truth a little bit. You know, I can talk about how I think this player is the greatest ever. And, you know, maybe I'm lying a little bit, but I'm pushing my argument.
Well, like you said, like in the stat book, it looks like an out or a strike out or a home run. It whether it bounced off the top of the wall or not, it's a home run.
Yeah.
It's a backwards K looks like a K if you're, as long as you're saying he struck out. And the whiff, I mean, you don't have to say that if you don't.
To quote from The Simpsons, there's the truth. And the truth from Lionel Hutz. And they are often very, very different. Matt, this has been fantastic. You know, you took us out on a two-hour tour. I felt like I was going to do something from...
Gilligan's Island?
Yeah, from Gilligan's Island. Thank you. But this one had a much better result. And it is so cool to get the perspective of the vineyards, of the different slates, of, you know, and the different perspectives that you're looking at.
Because
I think it really gives more of a context of just exactly what is in your glass and how impressive the winemaking is in this area. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Can I ask you one quiz question
of
for
course,
you?
Of
since
course.
You've drilled me so much.
All right.
You are listed in IMDb for what show?
Let's see. The Casinorama Grill.
You got it.
Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you.
That so made, you got but, Italy for the cause name and Casinorama Grill Room.
Yes.
Very nice.
Hey,
thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
As we end this, cheers.
Prost.
Prost. Prost. Thank you so much. That is Matt Gudritis from Dr. Lucin. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.